Jeremiah 19, verse 1. This is about Jeremiah smashing the earthen bottle. He's told to go and buy a potter's earthen bottle. And basically, he goes to the valley of the son of Hinnom, to the potsherd gate, and smashes it. Well, we've just been reading in Jeremiah 18 of how God is the potter, and he's trying to work with Israel, who are the clay, who are the dust of the earth, as it were. So he tries to work with all of us. And yet they are not responsive, and he has to give up or has to change his way, his intention with them. And yet they are so difficult to work with because they're not soft in his hand. And this is, of course, the picture, really, that we have got to be soft and responsive to where we are led on the journey. A lot of people like to think they're on a journey when in reality they are simply going where they want to go, or they think they're supposed to be going, just wandering around. Whereas God has specific intentions for us, but it depends on how soft we are. So he has to buy this earthen bottle, and that's the tragedy of buying a bottle and smashing it. He didn't just pick up any old bottle just to make a point. He had to buy this, just as God had invested so much in his people. And when things go wrong with his people or with us, this is a personal loss and tragedy to God, because this is a huge wastage of so much effort from none other than God himself. So he's told to go to the valley of the son of Hinnom, which would become Gehenna, the area that became symbolic for complete destruction and condemnation, which is by the entry of the gate Harsith. The Harsith means potsherd, and some of the versions say, which is by the potsherd gate. So this valley of the son of Hinnom, which is where the rubbish tip was, where the fires were always burning because the rubbish kept on being thrown onto it, and those ever-burning fires became symbolic in the Lord's teaching of condemnation. But it was by the entry of the potsherd gate. There would have been potters working there, and it got its name because of all the fragments of their broken vessels, the remnants of, as it were, pottery projects that hadn't worked out, just strewn all over the place. And so you see the connection between that and condemnation. The Valley of Hinnom was by this potsherd gate. Because God has tried with so many people, and yet they refuse to respond. And so the wonderful project that could have been is broken. And that is what condemnation is going to be about. Those who refuse to be part of God's program, those who did not let God work out his progress and his purpose with them. Now, this is so tragic, I think, that God works so hard in human life to try by all means to get us to be a vessel, as Paul puts it, that can be used by him. And yet human resistance is very strong. And you may say, well, how can it be strong against God? Well, it is strong against God because although he is a potter using his hands and trying by all means to form us into something beautiful, he so deeply respects human free will that he will not force us. He does not have the hand, or does not allow his hand, as it were, to be so strong that it is forcing us, that we are mere puppets, that we are clay that was picked up and forced into a shape. There's got to be some collaboration between his hand and us as the clay. And given all the tragedy of so many projects, if you like, that don't work out in the lives of probably trillions of people, I think I'm not trying to pat ourselves on the back, but God must surely be happy that we at least have said yes, that we in all our weakness and difficulty are still working with him and want him to use us. Well, the people are told why this vessel is going to be smashed. They're told, verse 3, I will bring evil on this place, verse 4, because they've forsaken me and have burned incense to other gods that they didn't know. So idolatry is called having a relationship or worshipping that which you don't know. But in the Hebrew sense of knowing, to know is to have a relationship. That's what it means. It's not talking about technical knowledge, factual awareness, or whatever. It's talking about relationship. In the King James Bible, you read many times that a man knew a woman and they had a baby. Well, they had a relationship. That is the idea. And so the characteristic of idols is that you can't know them. You can't have a relationship with them. And so if your idol is your home, your bigger house that you dream of, your fantastic car, kitchen, garden, holiday, all these things, you cannot have a relationship with these physical things, as it were. But you can have a relationship with God. And so I would say that one definition of idolatry, one angle on idolatry, is that an idol is whatever replaces God and whatever you cannot have a relationship with. You can't have a relationship with a bank account. You can't have a relationship with a stack of gold or a stack of money or banknotes or digits on a screen which reflect how much you have in your various portfolios. You can't have a relationship with those things. But you can have a relationship with God. And why then would idolatry be so attractive, seeing that you can't have a relationship with any of those things that people worship? Well, I think it's attractive because actually we all like the idea of relationship, but particularly in our postmodern age, we show interest in it, but then we pull back. Because to be in relationship, let alone with God, demands a lot. It demands us. It demands my heart. And people don't want to do that because I'm afraid we are increasingly, as a society, selfish. This is why marriages aren't working. It's why intimacy of relationship on whatever level is just not found between parents and children, children and parents, neighbours, etc. It's all okay if you see each other once a week or occasionally, but intimacy of relationship, no, people pull back from it. We all like the idea of it. People pull back from it. It's one reason why, although more and more people seem interested in God and spiritual things generally, real serious engagement with church membership has gone right down and it continues to go down. Because it's one thing to rock up at some great big church with thousands of people in it, yeah, that's okay. But to be an active member of a small church where you are all intimately involved with each other several times a week and phone calls during the week where your family, oh no, no. Nice idea, but people pull back from that. Let me rock up once a week, once a month, now and again. Yeah, at some big gathering where I can be relatively anonymous and nameless. Or let me go to a Bible school once a year and have very intense relationship. Yeah, wonderful time, but then let me pull back onto my little island. This you see in all sorts of ways. And this is I think, what was going on then. That God says, look, you've got all these other gods apart from me that you don't know, that you do not have a relationship with and cannot by their nature. They're just bits of wood and stone. And he goes on to say, because of this, therefore, you shall break the bottle, verse 10, in the sight of the men who go with you, and shall tell them, thus says Yahweh, even so will I break this people and this city, as one breaks a potter's vessel that can't be made whole again. So he wants to break the vessel to say, look, I am giving up with you. Babylon is going to come, destroy this city, destroy this temple, and destroy you, and it will not be able to be made whole again, apparently. But the miracle of grace was that, in fact, they were made whole. It was God's intention to do that. And several times, Jeremiah in chapter 30, chapter 33, is going to tell them that God can heal them. And the word for heal, the Hebrew word for heal, is the same as to make whole. This vessel is broken, it can't be made whole, it can't be cured, But God says, I will cure you. So in Lamentations 2, the word is used in a sort of rhetorical sense as Jeremiah is there in the ruins of the burned out city and temple of Jerusalem. Zion, who can heal you? Who can make you whole again? And I say that's a rhetorical question because the answer was only God. This idea of that which is irretrievably broken being put back together again is in fact used several times in another figure. Jeremiah is told to take the linen girdle and bury it by the Euphrates, and then he goes to pick it up and it's marred. And yet he wears it all the way back to Judah. The idea being that in exile they would be broken and made useless and yet used. Ezekiel, he has another couple. He says in chapter 15 that the branch of a vine tree isn't much good for anything, it's not very strong, let alone when it's been burnt and charred. But God will use that. Another one, Ezekiel 37, dry bones. Can these bones live? Well, they're dead. These people are dead. They are just bones. Through the ministry of the Spirit, the wind comes into them and they stand on their feet, a great army. That was the question. Could anything come out of this? Is there any life in this? Yes, through the Spirit. And although the smashing of the bottle was obviously intended to show that, look, this is the end, yet God so loves his people that he can heal that which appears to be absolutely incurable. And you really see this in the transformation of human lives through the power of the Spirit. I don't mean coaxing somebody bit by bit into understanding a set of theology and then baptizing them. I am talking about the radical transformation of human life in practice by the work of the Holy Spirit. For example, the person who literally is an in-the-gutter alcoholic, seriously transformed. Not a work of 5 minutes, and also not staying sober for 5 minutes. I have seen this. We had these cases, we have them in the Riga Bible Center. Men I have known for 10, 15 years go out for sobriety coffees together in the old town in Riga, with them paying the bill, because we remember how I met them, knew them, when they were literally in the gutter. Now that is a transformation only by the Holy Spirit. And so this is God's characteristic, that nobody is too far gone. I'm sure we all know people maybe in the far gone grip of drug addiction, or people who in various psychological ways appear to be so impossible to really imagine that they would ever be different, that they could ever be different. God can do that. He really can. But it is not of might or strength. It's not of psychology. It's not of counseling. It is of his Spirit alone. And, you know, I'm not saying he doesn't work through those things, but essentially the victory is his and not any secular methodology. So this was God's intention. And the fact that they chose to remain in Babylon when the decree of Cyrus was made to restore them is just tragic. God really could and was eager to do an absolute psychological miracle upon them. And he is no less eager and willing to do it in the lives and the hearts of you and me. Because in some parts of our lives, we have been pretty far gone. Although you may not, you know, be in the grip of material addiction, all the same, to radically transform a human heart is a huge job. And there is a lot of brokenness in every human being. It is not just in some. It's more apparent in some, but it is there in all people. And God can change this. He is willing to transform it. And the fact that so many refuse it, the fact that, as I say, at the potsherd gate, there's all these smashed bits of pottery from all the projects that didn't work, because people were not willing for this and did not want to be put back together again, this is a tragedy. But let's at very least ensure that that is not me. that I, at least in my broken way and dysfunctional way, that I will be one who is put together again for God's glory.